Namo Buddhaya.
Jai Bhim.
So in this series so far, we've, I hope, connected a bit with what bodhicitta means, and recognizing that bodhicitta is the heart of the bodhisattva. It's the bodhicitta that makes a bodhisattva. And we've recognized that the bodhicitta is a mind transformed, therefore free from self-clinging and free from suffering, and that it's a mind that is feels a deep solidarity with everything, feels no barrier, no disconnection, no boundary between the mind and its objects, whatever they may be. And we've seen that for us to become bodhisattvas, we need to connect very strongly with that mind as a felt reality. And we've seen that we can do that especially through the devotional come contemplative practice of what we generally refer to as visualization, but I think that's a misnomer because quite a lot of people don't see anything. And you can do this form of practice, this form of sadhana practice, without ever seeing a dicky bird. It can somehow be felt rather than seen. And yesterday we saw how we need to bring that right into our immediate lives by trying to track our reactions and try to trace where those reactions come from. In other words, trace where they come from in our identification with elements within our experience. And we try to undo those. They may be actual physical experiences, my body. They may be emotions, the emotions that I feel. They may be ideas. They will be ideas. Ideas are a very important part of clinging. We'll see that in a minute. That's why people become so upset when you disagree with them, because they've identified themselves with a certain set of ideas. Then they do that. So we identify with all these things, and we think of them, without really knowing that's what we're doing, as I, and we construct our identity out of those things that we cling to. So we saw that in reaction practice, we're learning to identify these things and try to see deeply into them and recognize that they have no reality. They're not part of the nature of things. They're not part of the structure of things. They're something constructed, and therefore they can be deconstructed, if you see what I mean. And then we looked a little bit at response practice, which is making the effort to cross the boundary into empathy, so that we're trying to arouse within ourselves solidarity, as I put it. Of course, that's what we're also doing in metta practice and so forth. But so we're trying to become bodhisattvas. That's what these practices are about. They're about connecting with bodhicitta, so that we've got some sense of something beyond ourselves as a narrow identified bundle of clinging, and we try to see that in our daily lives, so we let go of it. But what is it to live as a bodhisattva? Because if we want to become bodhisattvas, we're inspired by the bodhisattva ideal, we need to shape our lives in accordance with the bodhisattva's life, if you see what I mean. What does a bodhisattva do? What job does a bodhisattva do? How does a bodhisattva engage in life? What social context does a bodhisattva have? We'll see that more tomorrow. But what's the enterprise of the bodhisattva's life? Is the bodhisattva simply somebody who does good? It's a jolly good thing if people do good. It'd be very good if more people did good. But that's not a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is not merely someone who does good. Although a bodhisattva does do good, it's not merely somebody who does good. Otherwise, all social reformers, social activists, all kind and generous people would be bodhisattvas. To be kind and generous in itself does not make you a bodhisattva. If you're a bodhisattva, you'll be kind and generous. But all A's are not B's, even though all B's are A's, if you see what I mean. What is distinctive about a bodhisattva? And why is it important to make that distinction? Isn't it just good enough that people do good? Well, Shantideva really nails that one. There's a wonderful quotation from the Bodhicharya Avatara, which is a sort of constant refrain for me. It says something like, the power of good, the power of virtue, is actually quite weak. And the power of evil is very strong. By what other good can it be overcome? What other virtue can it be overcome than bodhicitta? What is required to deal with evil is not just a counterbalance of good. What's required is something beyond good and evil, you could say in a certain sense. What you require is bodhicitta. You require a mind that is not merely in opposition to evil, but is beyond the whole distinction. So a very, very profound insight that he has, and really deeply important for us. Otherwise, what can happen is, and anybody who's been engaged in any sort of social activism will be familiar with this, that you try, you do as much as you can, but however much you do, there's more and more to be done. And in fact, the what needs to be done seems to be greater the more effort you do into put into doing something good. And indeed, to sustain that sort of social and political activism, you require a larger vision. Very, very striking. I myself was very strongly motivated by the idea of social engagement. I worked for a while as a psychiatric social worker, not in a professional sense, but, or rather not in that exalted sense, but I worked in a psychiatric clinic. And I did so because I believed I could do some good in that way, and that was a way of helping to change the world. But I pretty swiftly realised that I did not have the strength for it, and that the issues themselves, which were partly to do with the way society worked as much as to do with the way the chemicals in the brain worked, that there was more than I could handle. And I did not have the spiritual resources to deal with it. And this is an extremely important question for us to resolve if we want to be bodhisattvas. What is the bodhisattva's project? What is it that we're trying to do as bodhisattvas? How are we to engage with the world? I'm not saying we may not even be social workers. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying, what is the larger project within which that is being carried out? And here I want to refer to the life and work of Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar, because I think he understood this issue extremely deeply, and in a way that nobody in the modern world, no Buddhist in the modern world, has really grasped it. Not merely grasped it, but lived it out, put it into effect. I think he's the key Buddhist figure of the modern era. He's the key Buddhist figure for, if you like, the modern democratic world. It's really exemplary what he achieved and how he saw things. We saw last night extremely movingly how one man, our dear friend Vivekaratna, became what he is And what he is so impressive because of Dr. Ambedkar. But there's a lot more to that story than he was able to communicate in the time available to him. I think you're extremely fortunate to have heard that story, because you don't often get it so eloquently and movingly expressed. Everybody's heard the stories about Dr. Ambedkar. We're very familiar with it in our movement. But I felt last night that you really got it. And that through Vivekaratna's purity, honesty and simplicity, in the best sense of simplicity, of course, it got through to you what Dr. Ambedkar actually did. The life that Vivekaratna came from is still the life of millions of people in India, actually millions of people all over the world. What has happened for him is absolutely extraordinary. I know people who still live in that way. And Vivekaratna, one of his jobs is to go round India, many different states, trying to find people from the same conditions that he was in and bring them into contact with the Dhamma through the wonderful work that he did at Nagaloka. But to really understand more deeply, you need to know a little bit more about Dr. Ambedkar's struggle. I'm going to tell you the story that is almost certainly familiar to you, but I want to put it in a particular way so that you can see the path of Dr. Ambedkar's own gradual understanding of what was needed. He was a very clear-sighted man, but it inevitably took him time to work out where the problem really lay and what really needed to be done about it. And it's because of that that he's a bodhisattva. He's a bodhisattva because he understood that and acted upon it. Otherwise, he's just another social reformer, another wonderful social reformer, who would have had a big effect, whatever. But there's something extra that he brought to it that makes him a bodhisattva, in my opinion. And in the opinion of millions of people in India. Even though they don't really understand what that means, they don't understand what they're saying when they say that, this is why they do it. So Dr. Ambedkar, everybody knows, was born into an untouchable family. I use that term because you cannot skirt around the issue. Let's be blunt for a change. He's born into an untouchable family. He faced untouchability. He had faced untouchability at school. He was made to sit outside the school. He was, at one point, he by sitting too near the lunch boxes of the other boys, he polluted them and they couldn't eat their lunch. He had all those experiences, thrown off a cart because they realised he and his family were untouchables and so on. So he had all that experience, but he's very, very fortunate. He was taken up by reform-minded Indian princes who themselves, for their own interesting reasons, which we won't go into, became social reformers, particularly the Shahu Maharaj of Kolhapur, Maharaja of Kolhapur, and Gaikwad of Baroda. They picked him up, they got him into good university, good schools, good university, actually also a Brahmin teacher at his own school who picked him up and gave him a life of the Buddha, which was his first contact with the Buddha, very young age, and fascinating. As a result of the scholarship from the Gaikwad of Baroda, he went to Columbia University, came on to LSE, was called to the bar at Gray's Inn in London, and became a highly educated man. And obviously went back to India thinking, well, he'd done what everybody else needs to do. He'd educated himself, he'd got out of the oppressive social situation he came from. Now things were going to be different. Very quickly, he realised it was not so. As soon as people began to realise he was an untouchable, they shunned him. the famous story that he was taken into the administration of the Maharaja of Baroda, the condition of his scholarship was that he'd work for the Maharaja in his diwan, in his cabinet. And what he found was that the peons, the servants who simply carried files from one office to another, wouldn't give them directly to him. They'd stand at a distance and throw the files to him. Because if they handed them to him, they would have been touching something that he was touching, which would have polluted them. You know, illiterate, probably, very lowly office workers could not face pollution from a man who by that time had at least one PhD, had been called to the bar, and was on his way to another. It didn't make a difference. It didn't make enough of a difference. And he realised what was true for him must be doubly, triply, a hundredfold true for those who had not had his advantage. So that made him realise that mere social advancement and educational advancement was not enough. Vitally important, but not enough. So he took up social activism, and Vivekaratna mentioned last night the famous Mahad Tank Satyagraha, where he led untouchables to the village tank in Mahad. Tank means big pond reservoir, really, I suppose we'd call it, where they drew water, thereby polluting it, so it only could be purified by, well, let's put not too fine a word upon it, cow shit and piss. When you put it like that, it sounds a bit more dramatic, doesn't it? That was purifying, whereas a touch of a highly educated human being was polluting. So he led that sort of satyagraha, he led temple entry agitation, and so on. He became active in labour politics. He joined with the Communist Party in Bombay to bring the mill workers onto the streets, who were terribly badly treated. He became active as a journalist, a political journalist. He started a number of newspapers. He entered the state legislature. People don't really realise this, but there was actually a degree of democracy at the local level well before independence. In fact, they were on the way to full democracy already. But he participated in that sort of democratic process. He started a political party, a scheduled caste federation. He did everything he could on the political, social, economic front to bring about a better state for untouchables, scheduled caste. Scheduled caste because they were in a schedule to a list of castes produced under British legislation. That they're the particular castes that are listed there. There's another list of scheduled tribes. And these sort of, it's a big development actually, for which often scheduled caste people are quite grateful to the British, because they did for the first time give them a recognised administrative status. They could have done a lot more, but at least they did. So he was active in those sort of ways, and a very active spokesman. He carried out legal activism. You know, as a high court barrister, he did his best to work on behalf of the lower castes and to overturn unjust decisions by the courts and so on. But he realised that whatever he did, it wasn't really fundamentally changing things. Fundamentally, things remained the same. And he was not at all in favour of independence on the basis that it was being sought. Of course he was in favour of independence. He did not believe in colonial domination. But he wanted to see social democracy before there was political democracy. Because political democracy without social democracy is merely the exchange of one set of colonial masters for another. This is what my gypsy friends say in Hungary, that we have democracy, but actually we are a colonized people. Because they're dominated by a majority keeps them suppressed. Anyway, we won't talk more about Hungary, that's grim enough. So Dr. Ambedkar became increasingly frustrated with Hindu society. This was a source of great anguish to him and disappointment to him. And he believed that the energies of reform were being pointed in the wrong direction. A little as the British had done, he thought that at least they had no interest in the caste system. The only interest they had in it was that, you know, they used the Brahmins and to some extent the Muslim intelligentsia to rule India. But beyond that, they had no, as it were, ideological interest in caste. So he wanted to see a radical change in social structure and social ideas before political change took place. This is a subject still much debated in India today. But he came eventually to a conclusion that he'd clearly been reflecting on for many years, in which broke surface in 1936. He wrote a paper for a Hindu reformist society in Punjab, in Lahore, an organization which wanted to overturn casteism and to reform Hinduism. They invited him to give a speech to them. And they invited him to submit a paper in advance, which they could publish with his paper. When they saw the paper, they disinvited him because he did not buy into their project. So he published this paper. 36, yes, am I right? 36, he published this paper, which is called Annihilation of Caste. And I think if you want to read anything by Dr. Ambedkar, please read this. It's dynamite. He's a very, very good writer. Very hot writer, but very reasonable. So you get passion and reason conjoined and a very, very powerful analysis. Bhante's referred to it as, in a way, Dr. Ambedkar's most Buddhist work, even though he wasn't a Buddhist at that time. But what essentially he does is get to the roots of the problem. He asks, what is caste? What is this dreadful system of graded inequality? What does it stem from? Where does it come from? And he said, well, caste isn't anything. Caste is not a fact. He said famously, it's not a brick wall dividing people. It's not a line of barbed wire. He said, it's merely a notion, a state of mind. It has no, in Buddhism we'd say no svabhava, no own being, no objective existence. Interestingly enough, I don't know whether he was aware of this. He may well have been, because he was a very well-read man. But there's a very important work by Asvaghosha, who is more famous for the Buddhacharita, a very early Buddhist poet and dramatist, actually. He's one of the earliest dramatists in Indian literature, in Sanskrit literature. But he wrote a work called the Vajrasuchi, the adamantine needle. With that adamantine needle, he teases out the existential status, the ontological status of caste. He shows that caste is nothing. Very, very interesting and significant. Anyway, Dr. Ambedkar uses pretty much the same conclusion, at least, and maybe you could even say argument, which is basically to say that caste has no independent existence. You can't cut somebody and identify Dalit blood or untouchable blood and Brahmin blood or whatever. I always say this in my talks, you know, if a Brahmin needs a blood transfusion and there's an untouchable who has the right blood group, he'd be very glad to receive it because it would keep him alive. So there's nothing objective about caste. That's basically what he argues. But then he goes on to say later in the work that what mind creates, mind can undo. So in this very, very simple juxtaposition of an analysis of where the oppressive system comes from a mental construction, and an analysis of how it's got rid of by a cleansing of the mind, he basically takes a huge step into the heart of Buddhism and shows us really what the Bodhisattva's project is and what our political social project is and what you, if you want to be a Bodhisattva, I, if I want to be a Bodhisattva, need to be trying to do. From the mind, all the evils come. From the mind, all the good comes. Whatever good there is comes from the mind. Whatever evil there is comes from the mind. There's nothing good or evil in this world, but thinking makes it so. This is Faust from Marlowe's play. So if we can transform our minds from minds that are productive of unskillfulness, of wrong attitudes and views, and can change them into minds that are productive of a right, a correct, a true view of things and the actions that ensue therefrom, well, we've transformed us. That's what we're trying to do in a way with the reaction practice. And if we can help others to do that, we begin to transform the world. It's as simple and direct as that. So Dr. Ambedkar, from that point on, moved more and more in the direction of Buddhism. He'd always been fascinated by Buddhism. He clearly himself had a deep feeling for the Buddha. Feeling is the right term for it. He was a very, very devotional man. Very strong feelings. And famously, not long before he died, he went to see an art exhibition in Delhi of Buddhist paintings and came out from the exhibition in tears, just saying, "The Buddha is so beautiful. The Buddha is so beautiful." Had tremendous devotion to the Buddha, but he understood the Buddha's message in a very deep, sort of penetrating way. That's the sort of mind he had. And that's, I think, what makes him a bodhisattva, not just a good reformer. He remained active in politics and, in fact, was able to enter into the Constituent Assembly, which in 1947, which wrote the constitution of what became the Republic of India. And he was asked to be part of the drafting committee for the constitution and was so clearly way beyond everybody else in his knowledge of the law. He was a barrister, and his erudition and his insight that he became the chairman of the drafting committee, which is a tremendous irony that an untouchable should write the constitution of Holy Mother India. And not something that people have quite forgiven him for, although they can't overlook it. And they try to brush him aside, airbrush him, as you might say. So he wrote the Constitution of India, which is still a very modern, very liberal, in the best sense of the term, liberal constitution. And he founded it upon the principles, as he says, of liberty, equality, fraternity, and justice, which he said, I do not derive from the French Revolution, but from my master, the Buddha. That takes quite a bit of understanding. We haven't time for it now. But he saw these as spiritual principles, not political principles. What he meant by that is another story. But yes, so he, and by now, highly committed to Buddhism, although not yet having called himself a Buddhist, tried to embody that in the Constitution of India. And India is still functions according to that constitution, even though there are efforts to undermine and subvert it. It's still what makes it possible for India, after 60 years of independence, still to be a functioning and effective democracy, the biggest in the world. He was inducted into the cabinet as the law minister, and he began to embody in Indian law principles that, you know, are familiar in any modern state. He began to draft a new code for the Hindu family. It's a whole story I won't go into, but he wanted to reconfigure the law that applied to the life of most Indians. It was a separate Muslim family law, but he tried to create a new Hindu code which would have governed, especially, for instance, the rights of women. So he tried to bring in a bill that would grant to women full equal rights to property and so forth. He was not able to get it through Parliament, and he did not have the backing of the Congress leadership, of Nehru even, who surely would have agreed with him, but it was not politically expedient at that time. One can understand Nehru's predicament, but Dr. Ambedkar was profoundly disillusioned and left politics, essentially, at that point. He was very, very bitterly disappointed, even disappointed with the Constitution. He famously said, who wants this Constitution? I'm paraphrasing. I don't. I'd be the first person to burn it. He's speaking in exasperation, you know, not to be taken entirely literally. It's rhetorical. He said, it's as if we've made a beautiful temple for some god to come and sit in, and it's occupied by devils. In other words, what he'd understood was that constitution and law is not enough. You can have the best framework of constitution. You can have the best framework of law. But unless people's minds and the social attitudes and the social system is in tune with that constitution, it subverts it. And this is the great paradox of democracy, as we know it in the modern West. Democracy is subverted by majorities, and in nations that have significant minorities, the majority can use the constitution to oppress the minority. I mean, we even see it in a sort of tiny and almost laughable way in Britain, that our government is carrying out the will of the British people. It wasn't my will. I didn't vote for Brexit. And instead of trying to produce a way forward that sort of meets the, as best it can, the sort of general desires, one party wins and ran through their desires. That's the fault of democracy. That's the problem with a modern representative democracy. Of course, there can be different ways of arranging democracy that don't quite so obviously lead to that. Anyway, I'm, you know, making generalizations for the sake of a point. But in the end, what determines how society functions is not the laws, it's not the constitution, not the administration, at all, you know, it's important, but what's most fundamental is the general perspective of society, the moral attitudes within society, the general outlook of society. I sometimes think that in a country like Britain today, which is probably one of the more radically de-Christianized of the originally Christian nations, we still survive on the pale remnants of a Christian morality. And I sort of fear where we're going unless that's replaced by a new approach to morality, a new underpinning. Liberalism is not enough. It does not have a sufficient founding in a perspective on what life is and what the meaning of human existence is. And it's not, therefore, strong enough to sustain itself. Much as I applaud so many of liberalism's outcomes. I don't think that liberalism in itself is sufficiently deeply rooted in human experience, which is why it's very vulnerable. So Dr. Ambedkar's saying that if you want a free and just society in which every individual is treated as an individual, that people are not treated according to their race, caste, class, gender, sexual disposition, whatever it is, you need a radical change in the fundamental perspective on life. You need a change in fundamental attitude at, in effect, what is a religious dimension. Religious in the broadest and deepest sense of religion, as not merely about God, but about the fundamentals of existence. What is this existence? How does it function? What is goodness? What is virtue? What is our purpose and meaning? Unless you have a widespread understanding of the meaning of human existence that supports justice and freedom, you cannot have justice and freedom. You'll have degrees of justice and freedom, but they will only be relative. So Dr. Ambedkar argued that, especially in India, where caste is supported by religion, if you want to change caste, if you want to get rid of caste, you've got to change the fundamental perspective on things. And he resolved from there on to devote himself to the spread of the Dhamma. And he said he wished he'd done this earlier. He wished he'd given his efforts to spreading the Dhamma, and he said at this stage that he was going to devote the rest of his life to the spread of the Dhamma. Unfortunately, he was dead within months of him saying that. But it's this, I think, that reveals the Bodhisattva project. The Bodhisattva project is to change the mind of the world. Dr. Ambedkar famously said in his very important talk in Kathmandu in 1956, just weeks, even days, you might say, before his death, he gave a talk on the Buddha or Karl Marx. And he argued that what Buddhism is about is not a violent change at all. He applauded the ends of Marxism, and he said he identified with them in many ways, but that the main difference for him was in the method. For him, the difference with Buddhism was that Buddhism wanted a voluntary change. It wanted to persuade people to change, wanted to help them to change their perspective and their understanding, so that they would thereby act in ways that were ethical and therefore would be lead to a just and free society. He famously said that democracy is not merely a system of voting. It's to do with the relationship of one citizen to another, a relationship of respect and reverence Use the word reverence, very interesting. Of one citizen for another, honouring each other, recognising each other's, we would say, individuality. He said, it's nothing but metta, maitri. That's ultimately what democracy is. It's maitri. It's ethics, it's maitri. Ethics is another name for maitri. Maitri is another name for fraternity, fraternité. Pour les Français, it's bandhutva, it's solidarity, in my understanding. So he argued that if we want to bring about this democracy in the true sense, not merely to do with how you choose the government, but to do with our attitudes to each other, our relationship with each other, there needs to be a change in the fundamentals of people's understanding of who they are and what their relationship to each other is. He believed that this change is best represented by the Buddha Dhamma, but he certainly did not consider that that was the only way, but he considered it was the best way, especially for India, and I think he probably would have said the best way generally speaking, because it makes these things clear in a particularly pure and unambiguous way. So he was fighting not merely for the liberation of Vivekananda. He did fight for Vivekananda's liberation, and what a good job he made of it. But he was fighting for something more than that. He was fighting for a fundamental change in attitudes at a very immediate level, at the level of mind itself, which he believed would naturally lead to the a just society. So in a very radical way, he outlined a political project. I believe it's necessary that there is social and political activism. I support that. I don't engage with it myself, but I support those who do, and I consider that my contribution is to support those who do. I do that in Hungary with my Roma friends, my Gypsy friends. I support them. They do the work, much more difficult, but I support them and help them to clarify what they're about. I do it with my Indian friends. I help them to clarify what they're about. And I try to do my best in Britain too. I try to clarify the issues that are before us. Because we need it here. Yes, it's not as sharp and clear as it is in a caste-based society or such a radically racist society as you get in Hungary. We have our own injustices in this very country and probably all the countries that are here represented. We have them. We have them, and we have a social system that is not productive of happiness. Depression is on the rise in a country like Britain or America. On these wealthy, wealthy societies, there's depression. Interestingly, far more than you get in India. People have got real problems there. Not to say that depression is not a real problem, but even when you don't have those problems in material and social terms, then the suffering that's within emerges. And in a way becomes sharper because the struggle is less clear externally. I believe that Dr. Ambedkar's project is the Bodhisattva's project. I believe that he outlined it with startling clarity in a situation that made it startlingly clear because of the very obvious injustice. It's not hard to see the inadequacies and problems in the societies we all live in. It's not hard to see them. And of course, right now, this very moment, the world has just got a lot more dangerous in the last 48 hours. It's we live in a time of great tension and danger in the world, with the rise of authoritarian nationalism and the heightening of old Cold War tensions and so on. It's not a good world at the moment. We need all of us to address that. We need to do something to address it. If we have any solidarity, we can't ignore it. That's the problem, isn't it? You're trying to develop bodhicitta, therefore you're trying to develop solidarity in the sense that I've been defining it. Therefore you're doing metta, you're doing your bodhicitta practice, you're doing your reaction practice and so forth. And all around you there's a bad world, a mad world. And what do? You just stop looking? How can you then develop solidarity? You've got to feel that what you're doing, even if it cannot answer all the problems in the world, is a response to the problems in the world at the deepest and best level. So I believe that Dr. Ambedkar, who was faced by one of the most unjust social systems that can be imagined, the system of graded inequality that condemned some people to what Vivekaratna vividly and correctly referred to as subhuman animal status. In fact, in Indian villages, cows are treated better than Dalits were. Really, really. Cows are decorated and loved. People love their cows, but not their brothers in the village. So he faced the worst, the most corrupt and unjust system. And he, with his extraordinary perspicacity, great dedication and fearlessness. You remember when Bhante saw him, Bhante asked him, what place do you think there is for Buddhism in India? And Dr. Ambedkar's rather despairing comment was, I don't think there's any place for me in India. That's the way it was. The whole of India was against him, at least the political establishment was against him. But he didn't back down. He didn't retract. He didn't stop going forward. And a man of the utmost courage and fearlessness, but this tremendous perspicacity and actually great positive emotion, even though he was a rather sort of grim man. Bhante describes his expression as being grim, as if thunderclouds hung about him, because he faced this terrible system of oppression and all that opposition. And but he never gave way to it. He never gave way to intemperance. He kept balance, he kept clarity, and he spoke out fearlessly, but never with hatred. He spoke with anger, the sort of anger that's required in order to make your point, get your point across, but never with hatred. And I think he shows us what the Bodhisattva project is. We're not all able to carry out the sort of huge sweeping change that Dr. Ambedkar carried out. Dr. Ambedkar's conversion, I believe, has only just begun to affect India. Dr. Ambedkar's effects seemed to have died out, but it's like a very deep earthquake. The tremors are still sort of shaking India. And even though, you know, the Indian political scene seems to be so contrary to him, I don't believe that his seismic change can be eradicated so easily. It'll take hundreds of years for it to really work itself out. But we're not able to do that. I'm certainly not. We're, relatively speaking, little men, and not at the right place at the right time. But we can all make our contribution. We can all make our contribution to helping to change the mind of individuals, helping to change the discourse in the world around us. I think we need to address what is being said around us. We need to try to bring a Buddhist perspective to bear, which is so intelligent, so balanced, so careful, so unprejudiced, that is the surmounting of prejudice. We can bring that to bear on the political and social discourse, the literary discourse, and so on. We've only just begun, as our order, we're much more further along in India, but even there, very, very small what we've done. But we need to have this sort of perspective that we ourselves are part of this enormous unfolding, which is the bodhicitta. It's as if it's not my bodhicitta, it's a bodhicitta that I participate in. And you align yourself with something very deep in reality, which is playing itself out in the transformation of individuals in the world, and thereby the world itself. What we do needs to be contributing to that. Of course, we do it very directly through teaching at our centres, teaching meditation, mindfulness, Buddhist theory, Buddhist ideas, creating a community. I'll talk much more about that tomorrow. But I think we also need to be doing it by actually systematically reaching into the debate that's going on around us and injecting our perspective into that, the perspective of the bodhicitta into that perspective, into that world. This is the bodhisattva's work. And if we are to really be bodhisattvas, we need to feel that whatever we're doing, and it could be anything, it could be being a doctor, it could be being a scientist, it could be being a teacher, whatever it is, it needs to be aligned with this much deeper, much larger project. And especially a very significant number of us, and many more than presently do it, need to be engaged in spreading the Dhamma. In the end, that's what's important. That people learn the perspective of the Dhamma, the perspective that's beyond ideology. The world is dominated by ideology. And ideology is always a distortion of reality. It's what in Buddhism is called a drishti, a view. And a view is always a partial perspective, never gets at the whole perspective. So, you know, we're surrounded by so many ideologies that all have something in them. Topically, forms of feminism, and in a certain sense, I'm a feminist. I believe that there should be no barrier to any individual because of their gender, their sex, their anything at all. Everybody should have the freedom to work out their own lives, and any adventitious factors should not stand in the way. There's an ideology that goes with that, which analyzes the way society works in certain forms of it, that are ideologies, they're views, and they do not always cover everything. In fact, they very often don't cover everything. They don't cover the lived reality of things. A lot of the language of anti-racism. And I'm personally very much against any discrimination of that kind. I've given so much of my life to working with people who suffered from that sort of oppression, because I appreciated the privilege that I had as a white middle-class Englishman as a result. The privileges that I had largely came from the racist project of the British Empire. And I felt as a beneficiary of that, some debt. But I think the discourse that goes with that very often simply leads to a new form of oppression and polarization. We need to counter these evils that the ideologies often are concerned with from the point of view of the Dhamma, not from the point of view of ideology. Be very clear, I do not mean that we need to go back into those oppressive systems, but the way we tackle them is from the Dhamma. It's a large topic which needs a lot more exposition, but the perspective of the Dhamma is ultimately rooted in the Bodhi mind, the Bodhicitta. It's ultimately rooted in a perspective that is beyond all differences, all distinctions. And we need to communicate that perspective widely within society in a non confrontative way. Sometimes we have to confront, but the basic perspective is not confrontative. It's actually beneficial. It's beneficial to all. I always say in India, it's not merely that the lower, so-called lower castes who need liberation from the caste system. It's also the upper castes. I often give the illustration, if you've got a man sitting in a jail and a man sitting outside the jail, keeping him in the jail, who's in the jail? Well, of course, I'd rather be outside the jail keeping somebody in than inside the jail being kept in. But still, if you're outside the jail keeping somebody in, you're in jail. If you see what I mean. An oppressive system is oppressive actually for everybody. Even those who are beneficiaries of it live in fear, live in insecurity. And so we need to address all and show all a better perspective on life that overcomes all these injustices and oppressions and inequalities and all this perversion of the human spirit in the mere pursuit of material gain. We need to communicate a perspective that is way beyond that. This is the fundamental Bodhisattva's project. I believe that the running of our centres is a political and social act. It's not in the conventional terms, and we're not therefore in opposition to political projects and so forth. But what we are doing is helping people to change their perspective on life. We're helping them to understand what human life really is, and therefore what value really is, what moral values, cultural values, spiritual values really are, and that will manifest in what they do. And it will manifest naturally, inevitably, in a free and just society. So, brothers, if you want to be Bodhisattva, you need to think about what your overall and underlying purpose is. It's extremely important. I saw recently in one of those researches on what produces happiness. A major predictor of happiness is that you feel you are serving a higher purpose. You feel you're serving a beneficial purpose. And surely the Bodhisattva serves the highest and most beneficial of purposes. So we need to get our minds clear about this. So it's a large topic. I've covered it rather briefly, and I may have said things that are not so clear or even a bit confusing or even contrary to what might seem obvious, but I'm sure you can work those out in discussion tomorrow. But I think what I've said is of the foremost importance. We cannot think of the Buddha Dhamma, we cannot think of the Bodhisattva as merely retreating from the world. The Bodhisattva addresses the world, but it addresses it at the deepest and most crucial level. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Subhuti. It's very, very good to hear that brief account of the life of Dr. Ambedkar. Really, really good to hear more about Baba Saheb. And what I found with Subhuti's talks, that it's just asking many, many questions of us, I think. You know, really love that thing at the end. The Bodhisattva can't retreat from the world. You know, we are engaged, but lots and lots of questions for us, I think, for the groups tomorrow that we can really, really get into. So thank you very, very much. Yeah. For asking those questions of us. Thank you.